Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You have now entered the House of Mystery on KXIM 98.3 FM Iowa with your hosts Al Warren, Kev Thompson, and Julie Sav.
Okay, you're back in the House of Mystery, and I'm alone today. Al Warren, of course, KKNW, 1150 AM. And we're just going to jump in it. I don't want to talk about anything. So we've got a great guest, and his new book is called True Fiction. And, of course, everybody knows him, Lee Goldberg. Thanks for being here.
Everybody knows me?
Yeah, I was, you know, yeah, I was just going to, I almost stole the introduction of, now I can't even remember, I'm getting old, but no introduction is needed, should be the name of the show.
Oh, that's David Letterman doing it with President Obama. President Obama is slightly more well-known than me, slightly.
Really? Just a little bit.
I haven't run any countries lately.
Lately, but give it a little time.
Yeah, I think I'm going to run against Trump next year.
Get in line. A whole crew of people, I'm sure, are.
I think a Jewish liberal Hollywood writer with no political experience has a great shot at the presidency.
Why not? No, but you're missing, you don't have a reality show.
No, I do not have a reality show. Though my life often feels like it, I do not have a reality show.
Well, you know, get someone like Caitlyn Jenner to be the vice.
So I do run into the Kardashians all the time because I live in Calabasas, and they seem to have some sort of alert system that I need to go to the grocery store or I need to go to the post office. So that's when they decide to go there with all the paparazzi and their film crew around. So it's Not great when you're in Calabasas and they're doing their show or they decide to leave their compound.
Wow. Jeez, the things we miss in these little suburb towns called Seattle.
Like Seattle, yeah.
Well, I was just down in L.A. and for 1 week and that was enough. So that's
and what turned you away? I mean, the traffic isn't as bad as Seattle and we have sunshine here.
Well, you know, no, because I'll tell you what it was. It's on my third book, the Oxygen Network decided to make it a documentary. And as pleased as I am with all that and excited, blah, 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 you know, all that stuff, I'm a real rookie at that sort of thing. And I've never had that as an intention. So I just jumped in there, signed all the papers and went down there, and it was just an awful experience for me. So
yeah, it must be awful when a big network wants to make a documentary out of your book.
I know.
We call these champagne problems, my friend.
Yeah, the white person problem. Well, you know what? The thing is, I could tell you some horror stories. And that's what I mean. That's why I'm not crying about it, but I am crying about it. But I tell you, I felt like I was, I was used and treated so badly at times.
Well, you're saying this to somebody who spent his career in Hollywood writing and producing hundreds of hours of TV. So I know exactly what you're going through.
Oh, and, yeah.
I've channeled a lot of that into my book. My book's a thriller, but the hero is an author and recovering TV writer who finds himself in the center of this giant conspiracy. But it's a thriller, but at the same time, I'm commenting a lot on the whole business of television and film, the whole business of working with actors and writers, and the whole business of publishing. So I was able to vent a lot of the frustration that you're alluding to in your experience in L.A. last week.
Very good. We'll have to get it. I'm just being a little bit of a whine, but it was, I'm pleased with that it happened and all that, but I was very naive to the experience, and I can see why people do have agents now.
You don't have an agent?
No, you see that? No, and there's one for the radio because we're syndicated now, and I need it for the syndication. And even when I talk to him, he says, "Well, you, I better go." And I was like, "No, don't worry about it. It's just," and I didn't quite realize that. I really should have had someone more involved in.
There's a word for guys like you.
Oh, yeah.
Chum.
Dumb.
In an ocean of sharks. Yeah, I can understand why you ran the hell out of Los Angeles back to Seattle. I'm surprised you had any money left in your pocket or any virtue. You're a lucky man to have survived.
Well, I didn't have the virtue in there when I went. But,
okay.
And the money, well, I just like I said, it was just sort of, you know what it is, it's just really disappointing, and I cannot believe how there were so many people, producers and directors that I had met, and they talked so good, you know, they're so nice, and they love everything about you and everything you do, and then once it's signed, sealed, and you're in there, they hate everything you're doing. They hate what you're wearing.
And this is a surprise to you?
Well, I guess this is my, I stay up north. I have a house in Canada and I stay in Seattle and back in, and so maybe I've just gotten out of the scene so far. I didn't realize that, it's so jaded in places that, I'm just confused that, and then it all comes together later. You realize, okay, they're all calling you just to get you on board, and they'll tell you what they need to tell you, and then after that, it's like, deal with it. I think the most frustrating thing, and this for you probably even as a writer, is when you've done research and you've done a nonfiction book, and you've done, a total, it's close to the bone and the meat to all the information you can get, verified a lot of sources, and you took a lot of time and you put it out there. And when that's there, and then you sign it and someone's going to do a documentary, you're thinking, okay, great. And then when you're in there and they're asking you questions about different situations that happened with the killer, then you explain it to them, and then they turn around and go, well, cut, a lot of cuts. Can we change that? And it's like, well, what do you mean? Well, can't we make it sound a little bit more unknown, a little bit more mysterious, a little bit more, could there be more? And it's like, well, you could, but you're doing a documentary.
Well, no, that was where you're making your mistake. They're not doing a documentary. They're doing a television show. And reality should be in quotation marks when you're talking about television. Their goal is to keep you from going to your phone or going to the internet or going to another channel. They want to hold you through the commercial break. They have to make each documentary a thriller, which requires them to be careful in how they present the information, to create a hint of suspense or a dangling question. Basically, they have to structure their documentary like a four-act television mystery show or crime show. That's how they keep you hooked. I mean, you see it every week on 48 Hours on CBS.
Right.
It's a different medium, and they're never going to get all the information you have in your book. And if they did, it would be so, no offense to you, unbelievably dull. They've got to make it move. I've never done a television documentary, but I have done hundreds of hours of fictional crime shows, and I understand how hard it is to keep a viewer on your station watching what you're doing when there's so many other distractions out there. So I totally get why they're trying to shape your interview, not get you to lie, but get you to create a sense of suspense. I'm not condoning it, but I totally understand it. It's a different medium, and if you're going to keep doing these sorts of things for Oxygen and other cable networks, you're going to have to educate yourself in the format. Watch a lot of these shows. Watch the best authors and experts and pundits who are interviewed on those shows. A lot of cops have gotten very good at it. There's a guy named Mark Safarik, who was a former FBI behaviorist. He's great at doing these sorts of things. There are a bunch of others who are just really good at conforming to the needs of television while not lying or distorting the truth.
Yeah. Well, I think that was probably the weirdest thing, is like when they were talking about his childhood and asking me questions, it's like, well, you know, about how many animals were killed and, you know, this neighbor girls were attacked. And it's like, well, we have no evidence of that. Are you sure there couldn't have been any or anything? And it took them about 20 minutes. And then the director said, well, we'll just skip the childhood.
There you go.
You know, so I guess, you know, I get it, but I'm just saying that it wasn't a great experience for me.
I'm sorry to hear that.
No, it's okay. I mean, you know, you're right. I got some sunshine. I got a nice hotel.
They send hookers, right? Usually they send hookers.
Well, they wouldn't send the ones I'd want. So.
Oh, okay.
But I was at the JW Marriott, so it was a nice hotel. Everything was fine. I shouldn't complain. There we go. See, now you solved
my
problem. See,
there you go. I'm a psychiatrist.
Yeah, you're a psychiatrist. Now, yeah, and ex-Navy SEAL, and of course a freelance sexual surrogate, and professional Daniel Craig impersonator.
I may have been a bit creative in my bio.
So you, I can see. I was working for you down there. Oh, now, so you are a New York Times best-selling author, number one. What is explain that experience, the very first time that happened to you.
Ah, the hookers, the drinks, the parties. It was actually pretty low-key. That came from a book I co-authored with my old dear friend Janet Ivanovich, and I think I was sitting at home in my pajamas looking at the internet, eating Cheerios or something at my desk, and saw it online. Oh, geez, I'm number one. And I called up Janet and said, we're number one. She's been number one a lot. She said, yeah, yeah. I said, so this is a big deal. She said, yeah, it's very big. Okay. Well, great, thanks. I didn't get any, you know, parade. I didn't get any basket. I didn't get – it was very low key, but it's career changing. I mean – In my career, I've been very fortunate. Just this week, my novel True Fiction hit number 11 on the Washington Post bestseller list. The other bestseller lists haven't come out yet this week. I've hit the Washington Post list, the Wall Street Journal list, the USA Today list, and it's great. And it's great not so much for your ego, because my ego doesn't need the help. Yeah. My wife and family will be glad to tell you. It's great because it tells readers that you're the real deal, that it helps them jump one more hurdle towards acquiring the book or giving you a chance. It shows you're a proven commodity, because it's hard to stand out among all the noise and clutter of the books out there.
Yeah, do you like the way the world's going in that direction? I mean, there's so many self-published books now. Everybody and their dog has
I them. Love it. Okay. I love it. It's amazing. It has given so many authors opportunities they never had before, not just aspiring authors, but authors who've been published for quite some time. There's what we call the huge best-selling box store authors like Janet Ivanovich and Harlan Coben and Michael Connelly, the big household names. Then there's the vast mid-list, and these are the authors who are neither best-selling authors nor poorly selling authors. They just exist in the middle, and it's a hard, rough life. Few of them can make a living at it. They have to have other careers at the same time. And over the years, a lot of publishers have dropped those mid-list authors and said, sorry, you're done. We can't make any money off of you. There's not enough readers. The stores won't carry you. Sorry. And then Amazon came along with this self-publishing platform, and these authors were not only able to republish their out-of-print books and make more money than they ever did when they were in print, but also restart their careers and write new books and reach an even broader audience. So now it's possible for anybody with a mouse and an internet connection to become a published author, to be on the same shelf with James Patterson or John Grisham or Nora Roberts. The downside is you're on the same shelf with those people, and you're going to have to be as good. Your book is going to have to be as well written, as well copy edited, as well presented, and as well marketed. Just because you can click and be published doesn't mean you necessarily should. But it makes it now so much easier and offers authors so many more options. If you're dropped by your publisher now, it's not a scarlet letter. You're not toxic anymore. You can go on. The bad side of it is there's been a tsunami of swill that has swept over Amazon and the iBookstore and Barnes & Noble of just unreadable, unpublishable, god-awful crap. So weeding through all that can be difficult. And that's where, getting back to your number one New York Times bestselling author question, that's where it really helps me rise above that tsunami of swill and be seen. So it's great. It's democratized publishing for the masses, but it's also made it harder for authors to become noticed.
Yeah, I've kind of felt a mixed bag because you do have a lot more options, but there's just so much garbage out there now. And
unbelievable, Matt.
It's not even spell checked. It's just an ugly mess, and there's no regulations on it, and that just kind of drives me crazy. But who is your biggest influence?
That's a good question. I don't think I have a single influence. I've been influenced by so many authors. I've been influenced by Larry McMurtry for his humor and humanity, John Irving for much the same thing, Gregory MacDonald for his rapid-fire dialogue and his Fletch novels. I read John D. MacDonald's Travis McGee books. Those had a big impact on me just in terms of social commentary and telling a mystery story. I'm a voracious crime and thriller reader, so so many authors have impacted me. Robert B. Parker also for his dialogue and his lean prose. I've learned so much from writing with Janet, and that's definitely impacted my work, certainly in recent years. I'm always reading. I'm always learning. I think if you want to be a writer, you've got to read. Or if you want to be a TV writer, you have to watch television. That's the best education, to learn from the successes and mistakes of other people doing the same thing you are.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I agree with that. You've got to keep on moving, keep growing. Now, this true fiction is part one of two book series. Explain a little bit what this series is about.
Well, hopefully it's not just a two-book series. Hopefully we'll be talking in 10 years when I'm on book 25. But it's not a series in terms of he's a private detective or he's a cop or he's a spy. It's sort of the unfolding, continuing adventures of a very unusual hero. My hero in this book is Ian Ludlow. He's an author of Jack Reacher-type thrillers about this incredible action hero who can fight his way or talk his way out of any situation, and who women just fall for left and right. You know, my hero Ian is none of those things. Like Lee Child, for instance, is a friend of mine. He's not Reacher. He's nothing like Reacher. And a lot of my friends, Lee Child, Brad Meltzer, a bunch of others, have been approached by Homeland Security and the CIA to consult on terrorism issues, meaning they want these authors to just spitball ideas that terrorists might do, novel plots, so that the CIA and Homeland Security can anticipate terrorist scenarios that they aren't imaginative enough to come up with themselves. This has been going on for decades, you know, back to World War II. It's not a new thing. So I thought it'd be interesting, fun, if my character, Ian, was one of those authors who consulted with Homeland Security. A terrorist attack happens that he anticipated years ago in one of those meetings with Homeland Security, and he calls up the other authors and screenwriters who are in those meetings with him and discovers they're all dead. And he realizes, holy crap, the CIA pulled this off, and all the accidents I've been having recently isn't just bad luck and being a klutz. They've been trying to kill me. And he goes on the run. You know, a guy with no special skills is now on the run from a massive government intelligence agency, and what's he going to do? And he has to become, essentially, the action hero he writes about. So I juxtapose his life with excerpts from the books he's written and, you know, the reality in between. And that book, you know, is basically a 3 Days of the Condor, North by Northwest kind of thriller that also pokes fun at the genre. The sequel, I don't want to give too much away because it'll impact how people feel about the first book. But in the sequel, Ian is in Hong Kong where they're shooting a movie version of one of his books. He's there doing promotion and finds one of his fictional plots becoming true yet again, and how he has to deal with the unbelievable, you can't believe it's happening one more time, and how he has to deal with this new conspiracy while he's on foreign soil. I'm middle of book number three now. I don't want to tip what that's about, but each book is very different. I'm not going to be repeating the same thing book after book, though it sounds like I am from what I just told you. It's not. I'm just being cagey because I don't want to reveal the surprises in the second book. But it's not a rehash of the first one. And I certainly acknowledge the improbability of the events of the first book or the situation of the first book happening again. That becomes a key issue in the sequel. So it's sort of the evolution of my character from being an innocent guy outside the world of international espionage, sort of being sucked into it, and how his experiences writing fiction and watching fiction are impacting that experience.
That's a great idea. You know, you should put it in a book.
You know, I should. I better get back to writing it.
Yeah. But when you talk about this book and you're talking about current affairs in a way, and you're really discussing, like when you say CIA and stuff, now you're as old as I am, and I have to say that how do you feel the U.S. acts and feels toward their agencies like CIA and FBI? Is it the same as it was 20, 30 years ago?
Well, it evolves. I mean, we don't want you want a jaundiced eye on the activities of our intelligence agencies. They don't always work to our benefit. Right. But I think what's happening now is you have and this is showing my political leanings. You have a leader who has done things that are wrong and is terrified of his wrongdoing and those of the people around him coming out. So his idea of defending himself is to undercut the legitimacy of the agencies doing the investigation. We've seen that before from despots and dictators and other guilty people. So in that way, it's different. But by the same token, I think it's good to have a healthy skepticism about law enforcement and the intelligence because they can overstep their bounds. I have to say I've done a lot of cop shows and I've written a lot of crime novels, and all the police officers and FBI agents and law enforcement authorities and forensic investigators and everything I've ever met have been conscientious, hardworking, and the reason they do what they do is to protect us and their families from harm. And they put their lives online every day for us, and that has to be respected. But there are people who use that badge and that authority inappropriately, and we need to keep that in mind. We don't want to go back to the days of Dragnet and the FBI, where we treated the intelligence agencies and law enforcement as absolutely wonderful and pure and totally trustworthy and would never do the wrong thing. We don't want to have that kind of attitude either. I think there's a middle ground between absolute trust and adoration and trashing the hard work that our law enforcement and intelligence officers do every day.
Yeah, I'm just not thrilled with the overall attitude of they're all bad. You know, just that whole, it's just they're, I don't want to say the words, but you hear a lot of bad talk about the agencies now as if they're all corrupt and the deep state, you know?
Yeah, well, it's craziness. It's absolute craziness.
Yeah.
And I like to believe that most Americans won't fall for it, but then again, Trump got elected, so clearly I'm living in some kind of bubble, being a West Coast big city person that, joking aside, I have friends who live in the Midwest, who live in Kansas and Kentucky and who voted for Trump, and they're good people. They're not racist. They're not homophobes. And I understand what motivated them to do it. I do. I do get it. I wish they hadn't done it, but I understand what motivated them. And I'm also hearing a lot of regret from those same people. So I think there might be a tide turning. I understand. I voted for Hillary with my nose pinched and my head turned away, but I did vote for her. And I just think we Democrats had a bad candidate, and I think it's a shame that it turned out the way it did. But I think we may see a turn in November, and I think we will certainly see a turn at the end of Trump's presidency.
You know, I really hope so, because this deep state conspiracy day to day is just crazy. You know, I feel like I'm living in the times of Star Magazine, you know?
But what kills me is a scandal that would have taken down any candidate or any president before. Trump commits on a daily basis. We've got porn stars who say he was having affairs with them. The things he says and does, and you think back that Gary Hart got thrown out of the race because he had a woman sitting on his lap.
Yeah.
You know, in a photo that went public, and they were all dressed and were just sitting on a dock. You know, President Clinton was impeached because he had a consensual sexual relationship with an intern. And you look at the things Trump has done and said, and it's astonishing. I mean, there was I can't remember the name of the Democratic political candidate, a presidential candidate who got thrown out of the race years ago because he won a state and went whoop whoop whoop.
Dean.
Yes, I mean, yeah. That got him out. But Trump could say that he goes around grabbing women by their private parts, and that all Mexicans are rapists, and nothing happened. Nothing.
Well,
we could catch Trump sitting in his office, smoking pot while watching porn on the internet and reading the KKK Monthly, and it still would not get him thrown out of office.
Yeah, there's a certain group that feel he's God's choice. You know, he's saving the way.
But just now the criteria for scandal has gotten so high,
yeah,
that it's unbelievable.
Yeah, I know. It's depressing.
It makes it hard for writers. I mean, imagine how hard it is right now for the writers of the new James Bond film to come up with a plot. How hard it is for me to come up with a plot when you're dealing with international espionage and all that, because the craziest things have already happened.
Yeah.
It's hard to out-crazy what's happening in reality.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll tell you, it doesn't end. But so now, what other things have you got kind of lined up? Because do you do other writing still for other magazines or newspapers or anything? Or are you just
I don't do any journalism anymore. I do still write for television, and I still write books. I have feature films in development. One is based on my novel, The Walk. Another one is based on a novel that I was hired to write. And I'm right now writing a that's a bad sentence. I'm right now writing. I am in the process of writing a movie for a Hallmark Mystery Channel, and hopefully that'll be shooting in the fall. So I'm keeping busy in both screenwriting and in novels.
Do you feel journalism has gone south, as a lot of people claim?
No.
Yeah.
And I come from a family of journalists. My father was a television anchorman in San Francisco. My mother was a feature writer, and my grandmother was a reporter in Spokane, and so was my great uncle. So it's journalism is in my blood, and I think right now journalism is more needed than ever before as a check on the falsehoods coming out of Washington, and also the propaganda coming out of some networks and publications. I think the time now, journalism is necessary for the proper running of our republic. It's necessary for our citizens to know the truth. I mean, just today, Trump was talking about how there are millions of fraudulent votes cast in his election, and CNN said that's a falsehood. It's important that we have journalists who are willing to say the truth in the face of lies.
I find that sort of the problem, because, you know, any major event that happens, like the Las Vegas shooting or the one just in Florida, within hours you have, you know, YouTube and frankly some anything Alex Jones, InfoWar.
Those aren't journalists.
No, I know.
Those aren't journalists.
Oh, I know, it's terrible, but they're considered journalism, and people go to them for their at best storytelling, and they think that journalism's just not telling you the truth. It's not the truth.
Well, anybody who thinks Hannity or Alex Jones is journalism is a lunatic. I mean, it's opinion. It's entertainment.
Right.
It's not journalism. There's no reporting being done there, and there's a enormous bias. I mean, Hannity just spent the weekend with Trump in Florida. I mean, he's his personal propagandist, and the people can't discern the difference between news and propaganda and opinion. That's scary, but I don't think there's any question that. And then there are people. It goes both ways. There are people on CNN who are not doing journalism either. It bothers me now to see people like Don Lemon and Anderson Cooper going away from objectively reporting the news and inserting their own opinions into their reporting. And I think that's a slippery slope. I think it's one thing to say someone is factually incorrect, like the president talking about millions of people voting illegally, as opposed to expressing an opinion that what the president is doing is wrong. And I think, say in the case of Don Lemon on CNN, if I were CNN, I would say that his show is, I would actually put something on the program saying it is news commentary. It is not news. But that's just me. And I'm saying that as a confessed liberal Democrat, that CNN, I think, is in danger of becoming Fox if they aren't careful.
Well, I'm sort of getting that feeling with most of them. Everything is becoming just editorial and not so much news. Like, I'm not getting news from any of these networks. I'm back to the local. I have to get it from the local stations here or local news people. You know what I'm saying? Like, to turn on any national news nowadays, it's just all Trump.
That's true.
And so much, it's so much opinion. That's all, you know. But another day. So what was your most... out of the books you've written, which one stays with you still today? Like, which one do you still comes to mind? Which one that resonates?
Resonates in what way? Emotionally for me?
Yeah. It can come out of the blue, but it happens every year, and something about it or something that you've written, it stays in your mind, and it returns every year.
I wrote, it doesn't return every year, but it certainly returned today when we had a mild earthquake here in Los Angeles. I wrote a book back in the early 2000s called The Walk, about a guy who's stuck in downtown L.A. when the big one hits and has to walk back across this landscape of destruction to his gated community in Calabasas in the San Fernando Valley. And I think about that a lot because that guy was basically me, and I got that idea because I was in the worst neighborhood of Los Angeles in downtown, just a god-awful neighborhood, shooting a TV show, and I thought, God, if the big one hits right now, I'm screwed. And it turned into a novel. And I can't help but think about that every time we have an aftershock or every time I'm in a bad neighborhood. It comes back all the time, that particular book and the experience I wrote about. Plus, I often drive the route that my hero had to walk to get back home, so it reminds me of that, too. But in terms of a book, I wrote a book recently that hasn't been published yet, which will be published. I can't talk about it too much because the deal hasn't been announced. But I wrote a book that was inspired by a true crime, and that true crime haunted me so much that I had to write a fictionalized account of it just to deal with getting it out of my head. And so that one still haunts me, too. So that was in a different way, and it's fairly recent because that's the last book I finished writing, so it's still with me.
Yeah. You could tell us, but then you'd have to kill us.
Or I'd be killed.
Yeah. Wow. So you're just a busy man.
I have to be. I have expensive wife and child and dog.
Yeah, I bet. You know, that dog probably, you know, living in the...
That dog has, I can't pronounce it, Swarovski crystals on her collar. You know, this dog is demanding.
I guess, you know, have to take it to the spa and
yeah,
to be a rich American in the
and you know, I've got my service staff to deal with. There's the butlers, the maids, you know, it's the gardeners, the beekeeper. It's really quite a payroll.
Well, quite the upkeep. Now, you were part of Monk as well.
Yes, I was.
Did you just write some of the books and some of the stories? Or
I wrote 4 episodes of the show and 15 Monk novels, and 2 of the Monk novels became episodes of the show.
So how does something like that happen?
I was writing for the show,
yeah,
and the creator of the series was approached about writing original novels based on the show, based on the character. These are not novelizations of scripts. And he said he wasn't interested, but he knew I wrote novels, and he trusted me implicitly because I was already writing for the show. He said, if Lee wants to write the books, then I'm all for it. And I said, sure, I'll write the books. And that's how it happened. And it was great. I really enjoyed writing those 15 novels.
When you do something like that, kind of on a series character like this, and that's been in a TV series, what do you find that you enjoy about it? But at the same time, what do you find that's not so enjoyable about it?
Well, the enjoyment is being able to delve deeper into the character, to flesh out the character more than you can in an hour of television, or actually 44 minutes of television. The bad side is that character is still alive on TV and doing things that and having adventures and stuff that may be difficult for you to reconcile in your book, because it takes 5-6 months to write a book, and then another few months before the book is out. That's a whole season of television. So you are competing with the character as it exists on TV, and you're competing with the audience perception of the character as it exists on TV. They see an actor's face. They have all that backstory and baggage going in when they read your book. So it's a plus and a minus. There'd be a tendency among weaker writers to do a very half-assed job in setting up the character, describing the character, because they figure, oh, everybody knows who this character is. I always approach the Monk books as if there was no TV series, as if everyone was approaching Monk for the first time in my books. And I know that the creator of the show loved my books. He says, even though I created Monk and I'm writing Monk every day, yours feels so much different in a good way. It's almost like having Frank Sinatra cover a song that you wrote. It's your song, but boy, old Blue Eyes really brings something to it. he really enjoyed it. He thought my Monk was a little more sad, a little more introspective, a little more melodramatic. There was still humor, but to fill out a 400-page book, 400-page manuscript, I should say, you need to delve a little deeper. You have to have more character. You have to have more story than you have in a 44-minute TV episode where everything is shown, everything is said. There's no introspection. There's no there is depth, don't get me wrong, but it's conveyed in a different way. They're two very different mediums with different demands. So that was a big challenge, and it was hard for me to be writing a Monk book at the same time I was writing a Monk episode. It was difficult to keep the two different Monks in mind. They're still the same character, but two different aspects of the same character.
And how did you come across with and meet and get hooked up with Janet Ivanovich?
Janet and I have been friends for, 20 years. We've been friends so long that we actually don't remember how we first met. But we do know we met probably around the time that her very first novel in the Plum series, One for the Money, was coming out, because she wasn't a big celebrity at the time. And I've just stayed in touch with her all these years. We would talk a few times a year, and I'd see her whenever she was in town. And we never talked about writing together. It kind of came out of a dinner conversation we had, 5 years ago, where we were talking about the books we like to read and the shows we like to watch and those kinds of shows, and books weren't being done anymore. And she was also real curious, like you, about how the whole Monk thing worked and how I collaborate with writers, because she'd done other collaborations, how I collaborate with writers on TV shows and books. And there was this long silence, the way friends often have in conversations. And she said, how come we've never written a book together? I said, you never asked. She said, why don't we write this one we're talking about, the one we wish somebody would write? I said, okay. And I think less than a year later, we were number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list. It was great.
Now, do things like that matter to you now? Being number 1 or number 2 or selling a lot of books or meeting some other authors that you might compete with or that write in the same sort of field as you?
Well, that's a multi-part question. The first part is, does it matter to me to have those accolades, to be number 1 or number 2 on the bestseller list? Hell yes, for all the reasons I said before. It's important for my discoverability, for my reputation, the sales of my book. So, yes, is it necessary for my ego? No, my ego is just fine.
It's fine.
but as far as meeting other authors, I absolutely love that. I have not stopped being a huge fan. And I still have pinch-me moments where I meet my favorite authors from my childhood or authors I truly admire, and it's such a thrill for me. I love it, and I hope I never lose that. It's so great to meet authors I admire, and I don't see authors, any authors, as my competitors. That's a big difference between, I think, authors and Hollywood. For the most part, authors don't believe if you buy a book, that's a book you're not going to buy from me. We help each other out all the time. It's a very, very supportive and open community. It's not backstabbing, dog-eat-dog, at least not among authors. Maybe among publishers, but not authors. So that's been great.
Yeah, yeah. No, I understand. I meet early radio people, and it's pretty exciting at times, too. But not too many anymore. So what's next for you, Lee?
I'm writing the third book in the Ian Ludlow series. I'm in the midst of writing it now, and I'm writing that Hallmark movie I mentioned before, and crossing my fingers that the feature scripts that I've written actually come to fruition. They've got directors attached, and they're making offers to actors, but I've been down that road many, many times before, so I don't get excited until I'm actually sitting on the set watching it being shot.
Right, right. Until you're there and doing it, you just don't know, right?
It's all smoke.
Wow. This has been amazing. I've really enjoyed talking with you. The number one New York Times best-selling author, Lee Goldberg.
I have my wife say that to me. Hey, number one New York Times best-selling author, can you help bring up the laundry? Hey, everyone now in my family, including the dog, has to precede my name with number one New York Times best-selling author. Not that I have an ego or anything.
No, but that's exciting. You can change your name.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be the same? Unless I change my name to John Grisham.
Yeah, well, yeah. No.
Or Dan Brown.
Change it to number one, New York Times. Lee Goldberg, best-selling author.
You know, you may have something there.
It can work. It can ring. I mean, it really could. And then you can be opening up for Nancy Grace.
Aren't I doing that already? I mean,
No. She's her own headline. Come on.
Oh, I thought your interview with her immediately preceded mine. So
it did, but of course she gets headline status, so she's... Don't worry, the editors take care of that. Sorry.
Well, you are getting the whole spectrum. I'm sure you didn't ask her the Trump questions. She would have torn your head off.
Yes, no, I do not talk politics with Nancy. You know.
In fact, I wouldn't even talk. I'd just get out of her way.
Yeah, you know, you just have to tread carefully. You know what? I tell you what, just in case. If anything, actually her agent is much, much worse. She can kill a man at 10 paces.
Ah, okay.
And I'm saying that live, so I might not be alive next week. But it's been a real pleasure having you on the show. And
it's been my pleasure, too.
This has been good, and I'm glad we... got to talk and talk a little bit about your new books and some of what you've done. I had no idea how much you'd really done. You know, you've done.
Oh, and we should mention, we forgot all about this. A large portion of the book is set in Seattle.
Oh, wow. I wished I knew that, you know, because then, God, yeah, we could have done a promo on that too.
Yeah. The first quarter of the book is at least the first quarter of the book is set in Seattle.
Well,
and Laurelhurst and all over the place. And
who's your agent? Get your agent on there. They never... that's terrible. I tried to take care of all the Seattle stuff. Oh. Anyway. Well, thank you very much. And
my pleasure.
And I hope to talk to you again.
I hope so, too. I got many more books coming, so book me now before I get too busy.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to get an agent.
Harvey, want anything special for your birthday?
Just a decent cup of coffee.
You're kidding.
I'm serious. Honey, your coffee's undrinkable.
That's pretty harsh.
Well, so's your coffee. You know, the girls down at the office make better coffee on their hot plates. Well, see you later.
And he didn't even kiss me goodbye. You know, if I could just make a decent cup of coffee, I could relax. So, relax. Why don't you try Instant Folgers? Tastes good as fresh perked. Good as fresh perked? I'll surprise Harvey for his birthday tonight.
Hey, great coffee.
It's Instant Folgers. Doesn't it taste good as fresh perked?
Better.
Better than those girls make at the office.
Honey, their coffee can't hold a candle to yours.
Instant Folgers taste good as fresh perked. Try it.
Holy fruit salad.
Now it's time for Dr. Joe's Conspiracy Countdown of the Week.
Okay, and we're back, and it's Easter weekend is over. And, of course, Kevin's with me, and let's see. We've got Joe on the line here. He's just ready to give us our after-Easter countdown. How you doing, Joe?
Very good. Happy Easter to everyone. He is risen.
He is. Well, okay. Good. So what happened during the rising?
Well, it was a quiet weekend for me, but apparently Easter was very busy in the conspiracy world, so I should have said the conspiracy theorists have risen.
Don't we always? Can't keep a good man down.
So I have a very interesting top three for the week. And I'll get right into it. So number three is actually true, but then the conspiracy theorists have taken it a little bit further. A NASA-backed study says that acid clouds on Venus, which are at 500 degrees Celsius, so very hot, may contain actual life forms. And what NASA was referring to was potential microbes living in these acid clouds. What conspiracy theorists say is that NASA is hiding the true life forms, which are alien civilizations living in these acid clouds.
So there are, okay, let me make sure I got this straight. There are actual beings, physical beings living in acid.
Well, it sounds like 1968, right? But it's
yes.
Not. This is a different planet. This is the planet Venus. And they're saying microbes, so it's very small life forms could be there. That's what NASA says. But the conspiracy theorists say, no, NASA's trying to hide the alien civilization in the acid cloud.
The domed cities.
Well, it reminds me of a Star Trek episode where they have the city in the cloud up above the, you know, they have the people working in the mines. If you remember that episode.
Absolutely.
So, all right, so that's number three for the week. That just gets us started. Number two, a little more interesting, and it's a riff off of Pizzagate that seems to still be ruminating out there, and it was sparked by Roseanne. As you know, Roseanne had a very popular TV show that just got brought back, and I think she had something like 20 or 30 million viewers for the
episode.
Wow. So Roseanne tweeted out support for Donald Trump, and she seems to believe that Donald Trump has been breaking up sex rings or pedophilia rings out there. So she thinks that Trump has been giving a bad rap, and she says that Trump has been breaking up these sex rings and provided some links as evidence of this. And the conspiracy theory is called The Storm, which refers back to a Donald Trump speech that he gave some months back where he said this is just the beginning of the storm, and people hypothesized that he was referring to breaking up the Democratic pedophile rings.
Well, he had some help from a storm, per se.
But I don't know. Maybe I lost it. Maybe I'm not thinking here. So why would Roseanne bring that up? Like, what's the tie here?
Sure. Well, that's what has everybody questioning, and I'm sure on our top three list next week we'll have some reasons why that might be. But for now, her character on the show seems to be a Trump supporter. But also Roseanne herself, she has tweets out that seem to be favorable towards Donald Trump, which don't make a lot of sense if you consider that she is an avowed socialist. But I think what's going on here is that Roseanne isn't so much about socialism, it's just she has an outsider view of politics, and I think that has sort of bent her in Donald Trump's direction. So she seems to be a lot more favorable of him than other more mainstream Hollywood types.
Well, how about this, Joe? This is just a thought, since we're all just sitting here talking, that maybe it's because she is a Hollywood insider and she's sick of the garbage that's going on that, you know, we talk about and we make fun of and, you know, we make into conspiracies, but maybe she's just sick of it and has thrown her support in a different direction.
Well, that could be true. It's just the one part where that goes off the rails is that the evidence she has that Trump is breaking up these child sex rings is they aren't really child sex rings. They're doing a lot of stings with prostitution. And the vast majority of people that they bust are prostitutes and johns and pimps, but not the child trafficking or the pedophilia rings that are hypothesized about, you know, on the Reddit forums.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just strange. I don't see her jumping on a bandwagon for him or for the opposition for any reason, because, you know, in these climates, you can ruin your free, you know, who's going to watch your show?
I will. Well, and I don't even like Roseanne.
You see, but that's just what I'm saying. It's so, you know.
Well, I think the question is, would she be voicing support for Donald Trump if she wasn't playing a pro-Trump character on TV and if the show wasn't already doing well? I mean, those are sort of interesting questions.
Is she a method actor?
I think that's the right question to ask.
Well, there we go. I feel better.
Number one.
And number one goes back to the girther conspiracy theory. This week.
I like good girth.
Yeah, yeah. I'm taking this personal.
This past week, Jim Messina, who is a former official in the Obama administration, has cited with a new form of the girther conspiracy theory. And if you remember, the girther conspiracy theory was that the doctor of President Trump lied about his weight and height and health condition in order to make the president look more healthy and fit than he actually was. Well, the new part of that conspiracy theory is that that doctor, Dr. Ronnie Johnson, has been nominated to run the VA. And people are saying that the doctor must have lied about Trump's health in exchange for a position running the VA. So that's our conspiracy, number one conspiracy theory this week.
Wow.
I can't even say that I opposed that theory.
Sounds very real, right?
Hey, I hope that doctor is still in charge for my last year, you know, with the National Guard so that I can make my retirement.
Yeah, you'll be in great
shape. If he's willing to lie about my weight, heck yeah, I'm like 6'2 and a healthy 175.
Healthiest man alive.
Yes, until I reach retirement.
Well, you can be whatever height and weight you want as long as you do your show on the radio.
Exactly. You know?
True. And get Roseanne to back us. We're good.
Yeah.
This goes back to the idea that somehow we expect politicians to be appointed to positions based on their virtues and not based on some sort of inside horse trading. You know, and why would we be shocked that Trump or any president would appoint somebody who did them a favor, if indeed that was the case?
And why is that so unusual?
It's not. It's just with today's media that I will say is incredibly anti-Trump, that he can't do anything without it being part of some conspiracy. So,
Yeah, but it keeps us in business, right?
It keeps the checks rolling in.
Now, speaking of conspiracy, ask Al. I have been waiting a couple, 3 weeks to ask you about this, Joe. I happened upon a conspiracy. It's not a new one, but it's one that I really think deserves a second look. And it is this, that each one of us with a Social Security number has an account that exists within the Federal Reserve.
Uh-huh.
And that if we have knowledge of said account, we can actually access that account to use to, you know, because we, as a citizen with this number, we have a monetary value. Have you heard of this one before?
Yeah, so this is fairly popular, and so there's a couple different strands of this, and some of it goes back to when we went off the gold standard. And some people say that you have an account with money in it. Some people say you have an account with gold in it.
Oh, boy.
Some people say that Nixon leveraged our lives when we came off the gold standard. Other people think that we have... that we're somehow separate from the government and not subject to any laws, as long as we know about this secret thing that you're talking about. So I've been actually contacted by prosecutors and by defense lawyers to have me come in and testify on cases about this, where people either have not paid their taxes or they've gotten arrested for something and they're going to claim that they're a part of this redemption movement or something like this.
Oh, like sovereign citizenry.
Yeah, sovereign citizens. So a lot of this is very similar. But anyway, the people always go to jail, and they never get money. So it could be true. It's just that it doesn't seem to work out in court in anyone's favor.
Well, let me cross that off my list, and damn. No, but I'd really like to explore this a little bit further with you in our next conspiracy roundup.
Well, I'd be happy to talk about that. I do want to get this in before we go, though. I received a phone call on the drive-in, and unfortunately I had to hang up on the poor woman. But this is not an invitation for her to call me back. But she said that her ex-husband had joined the Illuminati and was out to get her. And normally I tell people to either call the police or to get some other form of help. And I would have told her that, but I was driving through heavy traffic. But emails are kind of better for me to deal with this sort of stuff than the phone calls.
Well, Al, isn't she scheduled for an interview here in a couple days?
Actually, yeah, she comes on at noon today. That's Alex Jones' ex-wife is on the show.
Oh.
So she may have been...
Well, if you thought divorce was costly, just imagine if you got divorced and then that person became an Illuminati overlord.
Oh, my.
I mean, just have that hanging over your head.
Yeah. Well, you see, this is where you need a good agent. That agent would have told her. When she phoned you and said to her husband, you'd say, well, speak to my agent.
Easy. Easy done.
Well, Joe, thanks again. Awesome.
Thank you. I'll see you guys next week.
Awesome. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, guys. Sorry I was running.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.